The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the global section of the June issue, entitled, Nobody Will Evacuate These Poor People. Reaching flood victims in Russian-occupied Ukraine is so dangerous that only Ukrainians will do it. Where are the international organizations that were made for this? And this article was written by Anna Nemtsova. A 28-year-old Ukrainian medic, Helena Popova, traveled from Lutsk to Kherson last Friday to help victims of the flood caused by the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam. She went just to stay sane, she told me, across the Dnipro River in her hometown of Oleshki. Thousands of people, including her parents, younger sister, and grandfather, urgently needed food, evacuation, and medical attention. There, Oleshki was, less than 10 miles away from her, across an expanse of river and floodwater. The Dnipro was the front line, and Oleshki sat on the Russian-controlled side. When Ukrainian boats tried to ferry help from the right bank to the left, the Russians opened fire. After a day of work in the Ukrainian-controlled area, Popova was soaking wet in her shorts and T-shirt. Now she stood in the rain, looking desolately across the water to where her loved ones lay beyond reach. That Ukrainians can't get help to their friends and family in the Russian-held flood zone is tragic, but not surprising. Less explicable is the failure of international aid organizations, including the United Nations and the International Committee of the Red Cross, which have been conspicuously absent from the Dnipro's left bank. A little more than a week ago, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed his dismay at the agency's non-appearance. They aren't here. We have not had a response. The trouble, as volunteers like Popova know, is that crossing the Dnipro is manifestly dangerous. On Tuesday, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs explained that Russia had yet to provide the safety guarantees we need to cross the front line to the left bank of the Dnipro, including to Oleshki. As a UN representative, Saviano Abreu told me, "Our priority is to keep negotiating, but assurances from Russia are not forthcoming." For Ukrainian volunteers who have been delivering food and rescuing people and animals for the past week, the UN's timidity is maddening. Unsafe conditions have not stopped local efforts at a cost in lives. On Sunday, Russia fired on a Ukrainian rescue boat, killing three people. In the Ukrainian-controlled part of the Kherson region, volunteers supply water and food and have evacuated thousands of victims. Still, at least 10 people have died and 40 are missing. Kherson victims told volunteers that their houses filled with water in mere minutes. At the pace the UN and the ICRC are moving, it will be too late to rescue people soon, says Roman Timofeyev, manager of Ukrainian Rescue Now Foundation, whose 56 social workers and more than 100 volunteers help war victims. The Russian-controlled side of the river has likely fared worse than the Ukrainian-controlled side. Popova has kept a haunting recording of the last phone call she had with her parents and 12-year-old sister Vika on June 6, the day the dam exploded. The family was walking through chest-deep water, and Vika screamed into the phone, "I don't want to die. I don't want to sink." Her 70-year-old grandfather was trapped on an upper floor of a house whose first floor was entirely underwater. Popova's mother told her, "People were on their roofs screaming, 'Help, help,' but nobody came." The Kushtorish neighborhood of Oleshkia saw water levels rise above 16 feet and completely submerge the roofs of some single-story houses. One witness I spoke with on Saturday said that the current in her street was too powerful for even good swimmers to fight. She saw a neighbor die. Those who have made it out of the flood zone have taken their places in endless lines to collect humanitarian aid. Yulia Gorbanova, a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, told me on Tuesday, "There is not nearly enough to go around. It is a catastrophe," Gorbanova told me. "Nobody evacuates these poor people." The slow work and scant presence of deep-pocketed international aid organizations has become the subject of bitter commentary in Ukraine. In one popular meme, the word useless is superimposed on a photograph of UN SUVs parked in Kyiv. Alexander Mosiako, head of the communications for the Ukrainian Rapid Response Group, sent me photographs he had taken himself of six UN SUVs. "These vehicles are prepared to drive in water more than a meter deep, but they have been parked for several months in the center of Kyiv near a five-star hotel," he told me. "They are useless." Michael Borayorku, a Ukrainian analyst at the Atlantic Council, says that the international organization's response betrays shameful indifference, that there has been no rescue mission to the occupied territory in the full week since the dam attack is bad enough. In addition, he told me, some world players do not dare to come out, even with clear and strong statements that would condemn this new Russian war crime. Many Ukrainians distrusted the UN and the ICRC even before this disaster. They see the agencies as adopting a posture of neutrality that prizes dialogue with Russia over the protection of Ukrainians. In April, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres visited Moscow to discuss humanitarian concerns in Ukraine with Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The visit played very poorly with the Ukrainian public, as did Lavrov's subsequent visit to UN headquarters in New York City. Peter Maurer, president of the ICRC, traveled to Moscow in the midst of the battle for Kyiv last year as a neutral, impartial humanitarian actor. Many Ukrainians rejected the suggestion that humanitarian actor could be impartial in a conflict where one side had invaded its neighbor and was shelling civilians. The International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement has autonomous national organizations across the globe and involves the work of more than 10 million people. The Russian Red Cross, established in 1867, is one such society that could be rescuing victims in flooded areas of the Kherson region. But if it has done so, it has kept its efforts quiet. Its website reports no such operation, and its representatives have not responded to requests for comment. A Human Rights Watch report released this week said that Russian authorities started conducting sporadic evacuations from Maleski almost a week after the catastrophe. The Ukrainian Red Cross Society has been active in relief efforts since the start of the war, having distributed 8,800,656 kits of humanitarian aid and rescued 308,338 civilians. But its members often find that ordinary Ukrainians confuse them with the ICRC and misdirect their outrage. With regard to the flood victims, Anton Dubovic, a coordinator's assistant at the Mykolaiv branch of the Ukrainian Red Cross Society, does not think that the criticism of the ICRC's slow reaction is entirely fair. "The ICRC has no access to Oleski," he told me. "They cannot hire tanks, helicopters, or armored boats to storm into Oleski and rescue people." His organization is doing what can be done, he said. "We have been providing medical care, humanitarian aid, and transportation for hundreds of evacuees of the Kherson region on this side of the river." According to Ukrainian reports, Oleski, a town of 25,000 people, is currently 90% underwater. Other low-lying settlements in the Kherson region are in a similar situation. Every day now, Popova boards rubber boats or aluminum motorboats that foreign NGOs have provided and helps dress the wounds of flood victims, many of them farmers. As the days go by without word from her family, she grows mystified by the purpose of international aid groups that seem so easily stymied by the conditions of war. "This is a painful matter," she told me. "Here we all count only on each other." Next, Saturn's frozen moon just got a lot more interesting, by Marina Corin. Of all the celestial bodies orbiting the sun, Enceladus shines brightest. I mean this literally. This small moon of Saturn reflects nearly all the sunlight that touches its surface, because it is covered in thick ice, radiant white and opaque. It is the picture of stillness, except at its south pole, where geysers erupt from cracks in the frozen exterior, betraying the presence of something wonderfully familiar within, a liquid ocean. Scientists have spent years studying Enceladus and its watery plume, trying to understand the mysterious sea hidden beneath the ice. Today they have a thrilling announcement. Researchers have analyzed data collected by a spacecraft as it coasted through the particles of Enceladus' frozen spray, and in those tiny, free-floating samples of the ocean, they have discovered, for the first time, evidence of phosphorus. What is so exciting and interesting about phosphorus, you might ask, whispering so that the very excited scientists don't hear you? Indeed, many of us probably haven't thought about the element since chemistry class, but the detection of phosphorus in Enceladus's plume, and by extension, its subsurface ocean, is game-changing. Phosphorus is one of six essential elements of life on Earth. It has given us the wonders of cellular membranes and DNA. The best part is that previous research had already found evidence of the other five elemental essential elements in the vapor bursting from Enceladus. We can now say with more confidence than ever before that a little moon just a few planets away has a habitable ocean. Of course, a habitable ocean does not mean an inhabited one. This discovery is not proof of alien life, far from it, but it is the first time that phosphorus has been detected in an ocean off Earth, and a sign of tremendous possibility. Nearly everything that scientists know about Enceladus comes from a NASA spacecraft called Cassini, which spent 13 years in orbit around Saturn. Cassini zoomed through the icy particles gushing from Enceladus, some of which drift away and settle into Saturn's orbit, forming one of the planet's sparkly rings. In 2017, the spacecraft began to run out of fuel, so NASA tossed it into Saturn's atmosphere, where it disintegrated. But the mission had collected loads of data that would keep scientists busy for years. Of the fundamental components of life, phosphorus is one of the most difficult to detect. Brianna Henderson, a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who was not involved in the research, told me. And yet, when scientists analyzed Cassini data, there it was, embedded in the minuscule grains of one of Saturn's outermost rings, as sodium phosphate. The phosphorus likely originates in the depths of Enceladus from chemical interactions between seawater and a mineral called apatite, which, here on Earth, is the main constituent of our teeth and bones. Such minerals are not very soluble, Christopher Glean, a geochemist at the Southwest Research Institute in Texas, who worked on the new discovery, told me. Your teeth don't just dissolve when you drink a glass of water, or when you swim at the beach. But Enceladus's ocean is rich in the chemical compound we know as baking soda, and the solution makes apatite easier to dissolve, releasing phosphorus into the water, Glean said. If any life exists on Enceladus, Morgan Cable, a research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, told me, she thinks it could resemble the creatures that thrive around Earth's hydrothermal vents, where the sun doesn't shine. Here on Earth, down at the seafloor, you can see communities that have all sorts of different microbes, crabs, maybe an octopus or two, tube worms, Cable said. Imagine a colony of Enceladus crabs under all that ice, or even Enceladus shrimp. We're veering into speculation here about potential life forms, but Cable said that, given the mix of elements that we now know exists on Enceladus, such life is theoretically possible. Klein and his team say that Enceladus' subsurface ocean might have a phosphorus concentration 100 times higher than that of the oceans on Earth, way above what a healthy community in the Enceladus ocean would need, Cable said. But an overabundance of phosphorus could be a sign of a rather disappointing scenario, too. If any life forms were present, scientists might expect that they would consume a good chunk of that phosphorus, leaving only traces behind. Consider this example from Cable. If you leave a pizza out at a college campus and no one eats it, that definitely means there's no life around. Cable was more hopeful than that. Perhaps, she said, life is just getting a foothold on Enceladus and hasn't yet influenced the chemistry of that massive ocean. Cable said that studying Enceladus and other frozen ocean worlds, such as Jupiter's moon Europa and even Pluto, could bring us closer to solving that big existential question. If you have all the ingredients for life as you know it, you mix them together and you wait, will life form? She said. Or is it just super rare and Earth is the only place in the whole universe that has life and we're horribly depressingly alone? I really hope it's not that. I do too. Maybe beneath that bright surface, at the bottom of a dark sea, a quiet ecosystem of microorganisms is feeding on chemical soup. These tiny aliens would be entirely unaware of our existence and our pressing desire to prove that it's not a lonely one. But they would be churning away, navigating their world with as much purpose as the smallest beings do on ours. Next, The Toyota Corolla Theory of College by Sanjay Sarma and Luke Yokinto. Over recent decades, the price of higher education tuition has risen faster than costs in any other major consumer category, outpacing even medical care and housing. Despite that, for a while, applications kept flooding in, and for good reason. College was still worth it. As the MIT economist David Artur argued in 2014, the real lifetime earnings premium to college education has likely never been higher. Yet today, the value of college is slipping in Americans' eyes. 56% of respondents to a recent survey said a four-year degree was a bad bet. Enrollment has been declining since its 2010 peak, a change explained partly by the shrinking pool of 18-year-olds, but also by high school students simply opting out. From 2018 to 2021, the proportion of high school graduates entering college fell by 7 percentage points, a decline driven by falling enrollment in two-year programs in particular. These numbers reflect only one dimension of the various threats now facing higher education. Academic departments across the country are hollowed out and underfunded. The personal finances of graduate students and non-tenure-track faculty members are precarious, and students are fearful of losing their high-stakes financial wager on a degree. One common response from industry observers and policymakers is to urge institutions to focus exclusively on the value students are getting for the money they're spending, placing a priority on vocational education while paring back amenities, student services, administration, and supposedly unremunerative humanities coursework. After all, the argument runs, if colleges refuse to rid themselves of their excesses, they may find that someone else will do it for them. The Bloomberg Business columnist Adrian Wooldridge recently compared the United States higher education sector to the country's car industry in the 1970s, just before it was taken apart by the Japanese, hampered by a giant bureaucracy, contemptuous of its many of its workers, and congenitally inward-looking. The comparison works because Detroit's mid-century offerings tended to be oversized, overloaded with features, and overpriced. By contrast, Japanese imports, Toyotas in particular, were smaller, cheaper, and more fuel-efficient. When oil prices rose in the 1970s and the value proposition of large cars grew dicey, Japanese automakers were able to grab market share from American manufacturers. For U.S. colleges to avoid such decline, the thinking goes, schools must strip down to create an affordable and job-ready product. The impulse to cut education to the bone is not new. A century ago, a wave of school reform swept the country, propelled by the psychologist Edward L. Thorndike's reductionist theory of learning. Thorndike believed that learning was a solitary act readily quantifiable through testing, which was also, he and his allies believed, a sound measure of students' innate intelligence. Thorndike's sometime colleague and competitor, John Dewey, disagreed. Dewey argued that learning was a social, experimental process, too complex to be usefully pared down to its constituent parts. At his laboratory school at the University of Chicago, students worked together on interdisciplinary projects, motivated, according to his alternate theory, not by some distant reward, but by curiosity about the subject. By the 1910s and 20s, the heyday of Taylorist scientific management, Dewey's romantic, unquantifiable vision of learning didn't stand a chance. A generation of reformers committed to efficiency and standardization used tools such as credit hours, common grading systems, and uniform curricula to square off schools' idiosyncratic edges. Students, too, underwent standardization. Thorndike believed that native intelligence was fixed and unimprovable, and so an important function of school was to winnow out supposedly undeserving students. The one thing that schools, or at least other educational forces, can do least, he wrote in 1903, was to increase students' powers and capacities. Lamentably, he connected this notion with race, arguing for separate vocational and technical training programs for Black Americans. By the 1920s, administrative mandates were coming to dominate classrooms, even if the lessons were still run by teachers in all their variety. Thorndike had dreamed of someday eliminating them. If by a miracle of mechanical ingenuity, he mused in 1912, a book could be so arranged that only to him who had done what is directed on page 1 would page 2 become visible, and so on, much now that now requires personal instruction could be managed by print. Such a book is no longer so hard to imagine. Artificial intelligence could plausibly remove that last bastion of personal, soft influence from education. This possibility is alarming to those of us who believe in student-teacher relationships, particularly because of an ironic twist. AI's existence may place a premium on hard-to-automate, problem-solving, and interpersonal skills. Even if AI-powered instruction doesn't displace existing colleges and universities, it might still create a tiered system, one with teachers, another without. Already, educational standardization has brought unintended consequences. Especially harmful is the pervasive idea that learning, the fundamental objective of school, must serve double duty as a means to constantly sort adept students from those assumed to be inept. As we described in our book, Grasp, the Science Transforming How We Learn, a cognitive price must be paid when courses are optimized to compare students with one another. Such sorting gets in the way of context-rich, curiosity-fueled learning that leads to lasting knowledge and potent skills. In fact, if today's higher education sector and the 1960s-era Detroit resemble each other, that's because the same destructive degree of standardization found on the auto assembly line has been applied in teaching. Detroit's workers performed simple, repetitive tasks, and when defects appeared, they weren't empowered to act on the issue, only to flag it. This supposedly efficient practice produced tremendous waste, expensive repairs on completed cars, piles of defective parts, and a legacy of mechanical problems for motorists. Toyota, by contrast, trusted its small teams of workers to stop the production line and work backward to root out the cause of any defects. Suppliers built new parts only upon request, which meant fewer faulty items. Instead of requiring individuals to perform a task over and over, Toyota assigned several jobs to its teams while seeking their insights into how to improve production. To the delight of Americans who took a chance on them, the resulting cars proved remarkably reliable. By 1987, the company's Take Takaoka plant was producing cars at twice the speed of General Motors' plant in Framingham, Massachusetts, with the defect rate a third of GM's. Higher education institutions should consider pursuing a similar strategy, investing in students and teachers while stripping away many obstacles in their path. Online instruction can be used to reduce costs, for instance, but instead of simply shunting classes onto Zoom, schools should confine lectures to pre-recorded video and open up valuable class time for in-person work and discussion. Co-op programs that send students into the workforce can help them develop job-ready knowledge and industry relationships. More esoteric institutional measures, such as breaking the bachelor's degree into portable micro-credentials, could provide flexibility for students who have lately decided against even a two-year degree. At the beginning of the 1960s, Americans could buy just two types of cars: a mass-produced one, which was affordable for most but of inferior quality, or a hand-built one, which made superior quality available only to the wealthy few. Japanese manufacturers soon debunked this trade-off, showing that efficiency and quality could coexist. In higher education, a thoughtless approach to efficiency could entrench the pre-Toyota dynamic, leading to a small set of elite schools offering a human-centered education, while everyone else makes do with an algorithmic junk version. We don't have to limit ourselves to such a choice. We can have the best of both worlds if we have the audacity to build it. We are out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.